You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Turning Points in Spiritual History. They are lectures taken from collected works 60 and 61 and translated by Walter F. Knox. This is lecture 6 in the selection and is the last lecture in the book entitled Christ and the 20th Century. It cannot be denied, even by those who have made only a slight study of spiritual life, that the subject chosen for our consideration today has aroused an interest in the widest circles. We might add that this desire for knowledge is of a scientific character. On the other hand, there seems to be an ever-increasing tendency toward the formation of a world philosophy in which such questions as are associated with the name of Christ find no true and proper place. A previous lecture I gave some few weeks ago here, under the title The Origin of the Human Being, and a continuation of the same on The Origin of the Animal World, will doubtless have made clear to you a point to which I shall now again draw your attention. In every age, including the present period, the general conceptions and sentiments concerning such fundamental questions as the origin of the human being and others of a similar nature, including those relative to that being to whom the name of Christ has been given, are directly rooted in and dependent upon the accepted concepts of some previous age. We have already seen, while considering various matters connected with the origin of humanity, that as a matter of fact, those theoretical ideas and conceptions that have sprung from the general mode of thought prevailing in our time are fundamentally at variance with the actual results of scientific research. On the other hand, it is just in this relation that we find that the conclusions arrived at through the medium of spiritual science, which traces the human being's origin back to spiritual forms, and not merely to that which is external and physically perceptible, are in full harmony with the results obtained in the field of natural science. Perhaps nowhere do we find this want of accord so marked between the current cosmic concept prevalent in the thoughts and hearts of the people of our day and that which science has been constrained to adopt, as in the case of the Christ conception. This divergence may well be due to the fact that these questions belong to the greatest of all those concerning the cosmos. However, since the coming of the Christ movement into the world's history, human beings' power of conception concerning the Christ being and the form it has taken have ever been such as was best adapted to a particular period, or, one might say, was best suited to that section of humanity occupied with such thoughts. During the first centuries that followed the advent of Christianity into world history, we realize, in connection with a certain trend of ideas and spiritual tendency that has been called gnosis, a term denoting a higher spiritual wisdom claimed by the Gnostics, that grand and mighty concepts were formed with regard to the being whom we term the Christ. We find, however, that the universal acceptance of these exalted Gnostic conceptions continued for only a relatively short period, compared with that idea of the Christ which was generally approved and spread among the people, and later became the essence of the church movement. It will be enlightening to consider briefly those lofty Christ concepts that evolved in the form of Gnostic conceptions during the first centuries of the Christian era. Not, be it understood, because spiritual science would seek to cloak those ideas it has to put forward with regard to the Christ beneath a mantle of Gnostic notions. Such an assertion could be made only by those who, because of the immaturity of their development in the field of spiritual science, are wholly incapable of truly differentiating between the nature of the various events and conditions met with in spiritual life. In many ways, the concepts of the spiritual science of today, which will be recapitulated in this lecture, extend far beyond the ancient gnosis of those early Christian times. But this very fact makes it the more interesting that we should at least touch upon these old spiritual conceptions. There are many different points of view in connection with this bygone higher wisdom, and various degrees of light and shade in that olden spiritual trend of thought. And we will draw attention to one of its most important aspects, which harmonizes best with the teachings of spiritual science in our time. During the first few centuries of the Christian era, this ancient gnosis put forward the most profound ideas concerning the Christ being, momentous indeed in relation to the Enlightenment that came with the dawn of Christianity. This higher spiritual wisdom maintained that the Christ being was eternal, and not alone associated and concerned with the evolution and development of humanity, but with the surrounding world of the cosmos, taken in its entirety. When considering the question of the origin of the human being, we found that we were taken back to a form of humanity that floated, or hovered, as it were, entirely in spiritual heights, and was not yet familiar with, or embodied in an outer material covering. We have seen that during the process of the Earth's evolution, humanity, starting from a purely spiritual state, gradually changed into that of a lower and denser form we now call the human being, and that owing to the materialistic outlook of the present theory of evolution, which merely follows human earthly history backward, their beginning has been traced to external animal forms. Spiritual science, on the other hand, leads us directly to previous states that approach nearer and nearer to the immaterial soul, and finally points definitely to a spiritual origin. The old gnosis sought the Christ being in that region in which human beings had hovered before they assumed material existence, and where they felt themselves surrounded only by spiritual life and spiritual reality. If we understand this ancient gnosis rightly, we must look upon it from the Gnostic point of view, that when human beings had so far developed as to have reached a point when their etheric body should be enclosed within a material covering, so that they might take part in the general course of physical evolution, there remained behind in the purely spiritual realms what might be called a bygone companion of the human being, or, quote, alter ego, close quote, in the form of an element of the Christ being, which did not descend into the physical world. Further, according to this conception, humankind was destined to undergo a process of continued development in the material plane, and it was their mission to show evidence of achievement and progress. Hence, according to the Gnosis, this Christ element continues to dwell in the spiritual realms, while humanity undergoes a period of material evolution, so that during the whole time of the human being's earthly history, the Christ being is not to be sought in that region to which the human being is related as a physical, perceptual entity, but only in the realms of pure spirit. The particular period that we call the birth of Christianity, the ancient gnosis considered of special import in the evolution of humanity on the earth. It was regarded as that glorious moment when the Christ being entered the physical perceptual world to give an impulse to spiritual activity, for humans had retarded the soul's development after they had descended to the material plane. The Gnosis looked upon the primeval human during the very beginning of evolution as a spiritual being bound to a world in which the Christ was then active, and it considered that Christ again descended upon our earth, where for a long period of time humanity had been undergoing material evolution, at that particular period from which we now reckon our time. The question now arises, how did the ancient wisdom actually look upon this descent of a purely spiritual being into the evolution of humanity? It was regarded in the following manner. According to the Gnosis, an especially highly developed human individuality, to whom historical research has given the name of Jesus of Nazareth, had achieved such exceptional spiritual maturity that at a particular period definite soul conditions had come about, by virtue of which this singular personality had the power to absorb certain divine qualities and wisdom from the spirit world, which up to then no human could acquire. From this time on, so the Gnosis states, the soul of this specially selected personality felt itself sufficiently advanced to surrender to the indwelling of that divine being, who up to that moment had had no part in the actual progress and development of humanity, namely the Christ. The event that took place on the banks of the Jordan when Jesus of Nazareth was baptized by John, and which is recorded in the Bible, Mark 1:9-11, was regarded by this ancient Gnosis as a manifestation of the entering of the Christ being into the course of human evolution. The Gnosis further declared that some very singular spiritual condition had been engendered with regard to Jesus through this sacred baptism, which event we may consider as wholly symbolic or otherwise. We can obtain an idea of what underlies this Gnostic concept if we pursue a line of thought somewhat as follows. We begin with a realization of the fact that if we carefully observe the lives of other people, using those methods of thought that lead us to the very depth of the soul, and not the superficial mode so typical of our time, we shall often find in the experience of such persons moments fraught with epoch-making events, when they feel that they stand at a turning point in their lives. A situation of this nature may arise through some deep-lying sorrow or other trial of earthly origin. Then indeed they may say, quote, "That which has now befallen me differs from all my previous experiences, for it causes me to look upon myself as a person transformed." Close quote. It is certain that in the case of many people there occurs at times something in the nature of a crisis, such as might be described as an awakening and renewing of special and distinctive forces of soul life. If we imagine an experience of this kind as representing in a very imperfect and elementary manner an inner event similar to that which the Gnosis regarded as having taken place at the time of the baptism of Jesus in Jordan, Mark 1:9, we can then readily conceive an entirely different form of happening, hitherto unknown in connection with human existence, and quite unlike any that may break in upon human beings' souls, and is born merely of earthly trials and vicissitudes. The divine power and supreme spiritual quality that flamed up in the soul of Jesus of Nazareth, manifested in wholly new indwelling attributes. From them arose a godlike inner life, shedding fresh light upon all forms of human culture, enlivened by its example. It was the divine essence that entered into the innermost being of Jesus of Nazareth, that glorious and most holy spirit, creating in him a newborn life, that the ancient Gnosis termed the Christ. The Gnosis clearly realized that through the Christ there had come to humanity something in the nature of a new impulse, an impulse differing utterly from any that had been before. For all the godlike, stimulating power that was brought forth and unfolded in Jesus during the 3 years subsequent to his baptism by John was such as had never up to that time found a place in the evolution of humanity. The Gnosis states quite definitely that we must not consider a particular man, Jesus of Nazareth, as the Christ, as is oftentimes done, but that we must realize and look for the Christ in the divine spirit manifested in Jesus through those sublime and singular qualities that were latent within his innermost being. We have characterized this ancient spiritual wisdom concerning the Christ in this way, so that it is easy to comprehend. In the example previously cited, of a special turning point occurring in the life of a human soul, we have an instance, at least in some ways analogous to the Christ event, expressed in its most elementary form. It is especially difficult for humanity in these modern times to realize that circumstances of fundamental historical significance are directly connected with this outstanding incident, and which are of such momentous import as to form what might be termed the true center of human evolution. When we compare this Gnostic concept with various statements of spiritual science brought to your notice during these lectures, we find that no matter how we regard the facts, it not only has a grand and glorious conception of the Christ being, but also evinces an exalted idea of the inner being of humanity, for it regards the human being as being involved in an impulse coming directly from the spiritual realms, and brought to bear upon the actual course of humanity's growth and development. It is therefore not to be wondered at that this ancient Gnostic conception was unpopular. Anyone who has obtained even a slight insight into the circumstances connected with the progress of humanity during the early centuries of the Christian era onward, the existing state of the human soul, and the various conditions of social life at different periods, must at once admit that such concepts imply a loftiness of sentiment that was certainly not destined to find favor among the people. To appreciate this point, we have only to consider the spiritual life of the present day. Whenever conversation turns upon any idea similar in character to this ancient higher spiritual wisdom, the majority of people at once say, quote, "That is all an abstraction, a purely visionary notion. What we want is reality, something that directly affects our actual material life." Close quote. Thus it is that even in our time, humanity, for the most part, regards the old Gnostic conception, as outlined here, merely in the light of a wholly abstract impression. Humanity is still far from experiencing the feeling of greater satisfaction that comes of spiritual thought, and realizing how much more true is the substantiality of all that underlies those spiritual concepts to which we may raise ourselves, than is that of the things most people regard as perceptual, concrete, and having absolute reality. If it were otherwise, we would not find, as is the case in the arts and professions, that people are always urged toward what may be touched and seen, while all that is of the spirit and calls for inner upliftment of the soul for its apprehension is pushed aside and regarded as abstract and visionary. It is not possible in a few words to explain just how the popular conception of the Christ being evolved in the minds of the people. But it may be said that an echo of the true Christ concept, which pictures a divine being incarnate and abiding in the man Jesus of Nazareth, has lived on through the centuries, side by side with that simple idea of Jesus, which looks upon him as born in a marvelous manner, and as ever approaching humanity with divine tenderness and love, a theme developed even in the story of his childhood. In this concept we find Jesus of Nazareth hailed by humanity as its loving Savior. It is in that holy sense and feeling evoked by the deeds of this beloved Redeemer that we find a dim echo of the ancient Gnostic Christ concept. During the whole course of what we might call the external history of Jesus, there is found an upturned vision that realized the presence of a great secret truth and awe-inspiring mystery, which even as Jesus walked the earth endowed his personality with superhuman attributes. This superhuman quality has been termed the Christ. Moreover, we find that as time went on, humanity became less and less capable of understanding that bold concept, the Gnostic Christ, and this ever-increasing inability of comprehension has continued up to the present day. Already in the Middle Ages, we note that science dared to reason only concerning that which is external, and directly apparent to the senses, or about those things it conceived as lying beyond our sense perception, in a kind of world governed by natural laws. It did not feel itself called upon to probe into those factors and influences that have entered into and played their respective parts in human evolution in the form of noble and uplifting spiritual impulses. Thus it was that in the Middle Ages, questions concerning the origin and evolution of humanity, in which the Christ impulse made itself felt, became solely objects of belief. This spiritual faith, however, continued among the people from that time, side by side with all that was regarded as science and absolute knowledge, but which took heed only of the lower order of cosmic matters and events. At this point, it is of interest to note that from the 16th century onward, this twofold method of thought has more and more tended toward a crisis, and for the reason that humanity was always prone to direct and confine their powers of cognition to the perceptual world alone, and to assign all matters of spiritual origin and dependent upon spiritual progress and evolution to the category of mere dogma. We cannot, however, enter upon this subject at the present time, for it is more essential that I now draw your attention to the fact that in the 19th century, the course of development led humankind to a point where one might say all true conception of the Christ was wholly lost, at least to a very large proportion of the people. Nevertheless, we must admit that among a small section of the community, the ancient Gnostic concepts lived on, and were yet further developed after a manner that we might regard as bringing about a deeper insight into the Christ impulse. In the case of the majority, even among the scientific theological circles, there was a general renunciation of the true Christ concept. An attempt was made to center all in the personality of Jesus of Nazareth, and to look upon him as one possessed of singular attributes, and especially chosen because of his profound and all-embracing comprehension of the laws and conditions of human evolution and the divine inner nature of humanity. But even so, to be considered a man, though a man transcendent in all things. Thus it came about that in those days, in place of the old Christology, there grew up what might be called a mere Jesus life research. The results of this mode of thought and study became more and more incredible when considered in the light of all those divine qualities that dwelt within the being of the Chosen One, Jesus of Nazareth. According to these investigations, Jesus was to be regarded as one specifically selected, as endowed with supreme and unique spiritual attributes, but nevertheless possessed of human individuality. The crowning point in this class of conception is reached in such works as that entitled What is Christianity? By Adolf Harnack, and other similar attempts in the direction of what we have termed Jesus life research, and which have appeared in many and various forms. Footnote, titled Das Wesen des Christentums, 1903, Harnack's most popularly influential work, Adolf von Harnack, 1851-1930, was one of the foremost liberal German theologians of the late 19th, early 20th century. From his extensive studies of early Christianity and Christian dogma, he claimed that their development was a strictly historical process that could be understood through historical, critical method alone. End of footnote. For the present, however, it is necessary only to draw attention to the results obtained from deep and earnest study along these lines. Since this subject is the most modern of any with which we are concerned, we can do so very briefly. We would say that the methods employed during the 19th century to authenticate historically those events that occurred at the beginning of the Christian era have led to no actual positive conclusions. It would take us too far to enter into any kind of detail respecting this particular trend of thought, but anyone who will make a careful investigation into the results achieved in modern times in this connection will know that an endeavor has been made to apply the ordinary methods of external research to prove that the personality of Jesus of Nazareth actually lived at the beginning of our Christian spiritual life. This attempt to demonstrate the existence of Jesus by such historical means, as may be applied in other cases, has led merely to the following admission. It is impossible to confirm the personality of Jesus of Nazareth by external material methods. It by no means follows that the negative assumption, which claims that Jesus never lived, is thereby proved. These material investigations have simply shown that we cannot employ the same historical means to verify the life of Jesus of Nazareth as may be used to demonstrate the existence of Aristotle, Socrates, or Alexander the Great. But that is not all. Lately, this field of inquiry has led to serious difficulties experienced in quite another direction. It is only necessary to refer to such works as those by William Benjamin Smith, published by Diederich of Leipzig, to realize that the result of painstaking and exact research into biblical and other documentary records relating to Christianity has again revealed the fact that in many instances these venerable documents cannot be referring to those matters to which, during the greater part of the 19th century, it was generally supposed they had reference. A special attempt was made to reconstruct the life of Jesus of Nazareth from the results of philological investigations into these ancient chronicles. But in the end it was found that in the very writings themselves there was evidence of an underlying significance of quite a different nature from that which appeared upon the surface. It became apparent that despite every effort to picture the life of Jesus by employing the most carefully chosen and exact methods, the biblical records, those Christian documents wherein humanity feels itself upon a firm and truly Christian foundation, hardly mention Jesus of Nazareth as a human being. External science is thus driven to the following statement, quote, "The ancient records scarcely ever allude to Jesus of Nazareth as a man. They refer to him as a god." Close quote. Again, there is this remarkable anomalous assertion, quote, "It is an error to believe that any proof may be found in the original Christian documents of the existence of Jesus of Nazareth as an actual human personality. Rather do we come to the conviction that what the evangelical and other olden sacred writings state is that in the very beginning of the Christian era was a deity. Only when we recognize this fact does all that is written in these aged chronicles become of true significance and import." Close quote. Now, is not all this very extraordinary? According to the investigations of our period, when we allude to Jesus of Nazareth, we must speak of a deity. But this same period and same line of research admits of no reality in this God or purely spiritual being. How then does present-day science regard the Christ? He is looked upon as a visionary creation, a mere ideal concept that insinuated itself into the history of humanity and was called into being by a folk fantasy born of mental impulse. According to the latest investigations in this field, the Christ is to be regarded not as a reality, but as a kind of imaginary God. To put it plainly, we would say that modern scientific research is brought face to face with something for which it has absolutely no use. What can it do with a God in whom it has no faith? External science has merely proved that the Bible records speak of a deity, but it knows of nothing else to do with this deity than to ascribe to him a place in the category of visionary concepts. We will now compare the attitude of external science, as characterized here, with what spiritual science has to say upon the matter. At this point, I should like to mention a book entitled Christianity as Mystical Fact, of which I am the author. The fundamental idea underlying this work has been but little understood. I have therefore endeavored to set forth its object more clearly in a preface to the second edition. My intention was to show that the history of humanity world history, is not complete in that picture we can generally obtain from external history and external documents for this reason. Throughout all human evolution, spiritual impulses are at work. Spiritual factors are present. And these we must attribute to the agency of spiritual beings. If with this concept we compare the whole nature and method of the historic world conception put forward by Leopold von Ranke and others, we can only say that the highest point the science of history has yet reached is that it actually speaks of historical ideas as if they were subject to the intrusion of abstract impressions coming from outside during the course of human evolution and the development of nations and of peoples. That is the utmost extent of general belief in this direction. But ideas are not what historians consider them to be, and do not develop force and exhibit power. The whole process of human evolution would be a lifeless and spiritless, the whole process of human evolution would be lifeless and spiritless if it proceeded merely historically, and if it were not that those ideas that enter into the souls of human beings are the expression of invisible and supersensible impulses which rule and govern the whole of human growth and development. Behind all that is revealed in this external progression, there still remains something that can be unveiled only by those supersensible means at the disposal of spiritual science, where the methods are applicable to things beyond the powers of our sense perception. Attention has already been drawn to this subject in a previous lecture, and we shall again refer to it at a future date. I could demonstrate to you how the Christ impulse entered historically into the evolution of humanity in such a way that it proved itself to be an actual continuation of the self-same influence that played its part in the spiritual development of humankind in the old days of the ancient mysteries, the actual nature of which is but little understood. A true comprehension of all that was accomplished in pre-Christian times by the old mysteries, in connection with the laying down of spiritual foundations for the development of nations and of peoples, can arise only when through the methods of modern spiritual science, humanity has gained an understanding of that particular form of development through which the soul is transformed into an instrument capable of apprehending that spirit world that lies behind all things material and perceptual. In these lectures, I have many times referred to transformations of this character. We now know that human beings, who in these days are in a sense confined and interested only in the immediate experiences of their intimate soul lives, may truly raise themselves above their present state and assume a more perfect form of soul being, which can live in the spirit world even as the human counterpart lives in the physical world. Through the study of history in the light of spiritual science, we learn that the possibility of raising the soul being to spiritual heights through a process of purely intimate individual soul development has come about gradually during the evolution of humanity and was not known in primeval times. Whereas the soul may now, through its own effort and measures, rise freely, and while still possessed of its individual quality, acquire the power of spiritual discernment, in pre-Christian times, such was not the case. For the soul was then dependent upon an impulse born of certain modes and procedures that were a part of the rites performed in the sanctuaries of the mysteries. In titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, I have presented a somewhat detailed account of those ancient rites conducted by the priests in connection with the soul. These ceremonies took place in the various temples of the mysteries, as they were then considered to be, but which in this lecture we will regard more as temples assigned to spiritual instruction. What actually took place in these sanctuaries may be briefly outlined as follows. By means of certain methods and observances, the soul was freed from its bodily covering, and it was made possible for it to remain for a time in a condition similar to, though in many ways differing from, the ordinary sleep state. When we consider the sleep state in the light of spiritual science, we see that while the human frame remains quiescent and sleeping, the actual center of the human etheric body is situated outside the recumbent figure, and that during such state, the power of the true inner essence of this etheric nucleus is so low that unconsciousness supervenes and the nucleus becomes, as it were, enveloped in darkness. The methods employed during these ancient mystic rites in order to affect the human soul were as follows. Through the influence of certain advanced personalities who had themselves passed through similar mystical initiation, a species of sleep state was first induced. This was of such nature that the inner forces of the soul were thereby strengthened and intensified. When a certain stage was reached, the soul left the body, which was then in a condition of death-like sleep, and for a time entered upon a psychic existence, a kind of sleep life, during which it could look upon the spirit world with full consciousness. While this sleep life continued, the soul was able to realize its true position as an inhabitant of the spiritual realms. When, in due course, the soul was brought back once again to ordinary, mundane conditions, there came to it recollections of all those things it had observed and experienced while freed from the body. It was then that it could, while active within the human form, come before the people and stand forth as a prophet, bringing to them proofs of the existence of a spirit world and of an eternal life to come. In those olden days it was, in the manner indicated here, that the soul was enabled to take part in a life of the spiritual realms. In the mysteries were found the canons to which it must submit, and for a long period, in order that the supreme spiritual leaders in the ancient mystery sanctuaries might bring about the final consummation of the soul's desire. We will now ask this question. Whence came those ancient standards of human conduct that have been passed on by peoples spread throughout the world during the course of human evolution, and those flashes of spiritual enlightenment proclaiming our godlike origin and the eternity of the soul? The answer comes through spiritual science. From it we learn that this old wisdom originated with those who had themselves undergone initiation after the manner we have outlined. There is a reflection of these primeval moral precedents manifested in strange and curious fashion in connection with myths and legends and various graphic portrayals of the past. In these very fables we find depicted many of the same experiences that came as if in a living dream to the initiates in the mystery sanctuaries. Indeed, we first begin to understand mythology rightly when we regard the forms and figures there presented as pictorial representations of things that appeared to the spiritual vision of the initiates during the time of their participation in the secret rites. If we would establish a relation between the mythological conceptions of long ago times and the religious teachings of an earlier age, we must hark back to the ancient mysteries and ponder all that lay concealed therein, deeply hidden from a profane external world. These mysteries were revealed to those alone who, through severe trials and unswerving observance of that secrecy and restraint imposed upon all, had truly fitted themselves to take part in the dark ceremonies of initiation. We cannot, however, at this point, enter into the actual circumstances that led to the close veiling of the mystic rites performed in that remote gray past. When we turn our gaze backward and follow the course of spiritual development in pre-Christian times, however, we realize that it was always in the dim obscurity enshrouding the inscrutable observances of that bygone age that the human soul unfolded and was strengthened. The souls of human beings were not so fully developed in the past that they could of themselves, and through their own efforts, rise upward and enter the realms of the Spirit, while remaining merely dependent upon their immediate powers and unaided by the ministrations of the temple priests. In Titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, I have pointed out that even while external history ran its course, a change was taking place. It has there been my object to show how the whole plan and design underlying human evolution was such that when the turning point was reached that marked the birth of Christianity, humankind was already prepared to enter upon a new era. This change had come about because of all that human beings had experienced and absorbed through repeated reincarnations and through knowledge gained from initiates concerning the spirit world. From then on, they would have the power of upliftment to spiritual heights within their own innermost soul, which could henceforth rise of its own effort, free from all external influence and unaided by those means it was the custom to employ in the bygone days of the mysteries. According to the views we now hold, the most outstanding event that came to pass in Palestine in connection with the spiritual progress of humanity was the final perfecting of the soul, so that it should be fitted for what we might call self-initiation. This ultimate consummation had been approached gradually, and the necessary preparation had extended over possibly hundreds of years. The end came just about at the very time when that special turning point was reached, which marked the beginning of the Christian era. The soul was then so far perfected that it was ready for self-initiation, during which it would be merely guided by those having knowledge of this true path and of the trials that must be endured. Henceforth, self-initiation might be achieved without external aid rendered by temple priests or by leaders having an understanding of the mysteries. Furthermore, through the founding of Christianity, all those other rites and observances that were performed time and time again in the innermost sanctuaries of the temples, memories of which are still preserved in legends, myths, and mythologies connected with folklore, are found to have a place in that grand plan that underlies the world's history. If we would indeed understand the Gospels, we should ask ourselves the following question. What experiences were essential to a candidate for initiation in the days of the ancient Persians or Egyptians, who desired so to uplift their souls that they might gaze directly upon the spirit world? Injunctions concerning such matters were clearly set forth and formed the basis of what we might term a ritual of initiation. These commands and instructions covered a time extending from a certain event designated by some as the baptism, and by others as the temptation, up to that point when the soul was led forth and blessed with a true discernment of the spiritual realms. When we compare such initiation rituals with the most important statements contained in the Gospels, then, as I have shown in Titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, we find that in the Gospels there appear once again detailed narratives concerning ancient initiation ceremonies. But here the descriptions have reference to that great outstanding historical character, Jesus of Nazareth. It further becomes clear that whereas in previous times an initiation candidate was raised to spiritual heights in the seclusion of the temples of the mysteries, Jesus of Nazareth, because of the course history had taken, was already so far advanced that he not only remembered his experiences in the spirit world, and thus brought enlightenment to humanity, but also became unified in spirit with one to whom no earthly being had as yet become united, the Christ being. Thus we find a great similarity between the descriptions of the course of the ancient forms of initiation and the narrative of the spiritual development of Jesus of Nazareth up to that moment when the Christ entered into his soul and during the following 3 years, when he drew inspiration and wisdom from this divine source. In the accounts that tell us of all the trials and experiences Jesus of Nazareth underwent in those days, we find the events connected with his initiation clearly marked by the magnitude and godlike nature of the spiritual facts that underlie the historical descriptions. This is especially noticeable in the Gospel of John. While in previous times countless aspirants had taken part in the sacred rites, they had advanced only to that point when they could testify as follows, quote, "The spiritual world is a reality, and to such a world does the human soul belong." Close quote. But when it came to pass that Jesus was himself initiated, he became actually unified and at one with the most significant and outstanding of all spiritual beings ever remembered by former initiates. It was toward this supreme initiation that the ordered plan underlying all ancient forms and ceremonies had its trend. Even though what we may term the human being's deepest life center has always been near at hand, the awareness of this life center had not, up to the time of that great happening, really penetrated into the consciousness of humanity. It was ordained that through the mystery of Golgotha, human beings' eyes should be opened, and a new era be entered upon, in which it would be realized that in the life center, the ego, there manifests an element common to both the individual human being and the entire cosmos. Thus do we behold the mystery of Golgotha emerging from those secrets hidden in the dark mysteries of the past, to take its place in that grand design so fundamental to the world's history. As long as human beings refuse to believe that in a certain locality and at a definite time, Jesus of Nazareth was blessed with divine initiation and imbued with the Spirit of the Christ in such manner that this almighty influence could stream forth and act as an impulse upon all future generations, just so long will they remain unable to realize the true import and meaning of the Christ impulse in its relation to the evolution of humanity. When, through the study of the basic principles of spiritual science, the reality of great spiritual events, such as we have portrayed, is admitted, then will first dawn a true comprehension of all that has come to human evolution through the advent of the Christ impulse. Then we shall no longer degrade the Gospels by discovering in them four separate rituals of initiation in which matters and circumstances concerning Jesus of Nazareth are hidden away and mysteriously concealed. When we come to understand these things rightly, we will realize that everything that followed as a result of the event in Palestine held a deep significance for all later periods of human evolution. If we would know in what manner this great and vital change wrought in the world's history by the coming of the Christ impulse is regarded when viewed in the light of spiritual science, then we must first realize that the human being consists of a physical body, an etheric or life body, and an astral body. Deep within and underlying all is the ego, that true I which continues from incarnation to incarnation. An awareness of the presence of this ultimate center of life broke in upon human consciousness, last of all, such that in pre-Christian times humans had no thought of its existence. Even as the physical body is directly united and in contact with the physical world, and the astral body with the astral world, so is the human being's deepest life center, the ego, born of that spirit world that passes the human being's uttermost understanding. Hence the great message that Christianity and the Christ impulse brought to humankind may be thus expressed. Seek not the deity and the godlike primordial principle in the astral body, but in the human being's innermost being, for there abides the true ego. Previous to the advent of Christianity, people would exclaim, quote, "My soul is indeed rooted in the divine. It is the divine quality alone that can extend the vision and bring to me true enlightenment. through the powers of those who have a deeper knowledge of spiritual matters, close quote. But now people are learning to say, quote, if you would truly know where you can unveil the profoundest depths of all that is divine and active throughout the world, look within your ego. For therein lies the channel through which comes to you the Word of God. His voice will break in upon your conscious state if you rightly understand that because of the mystery of Golgotha, the powers that are of God have entered into humanity. And if thou will realize that then indeed was a glorious initiation truly consummated, to stand forth as a grand historical event. But especially does God speak to you if you exalt yourself and make your soul an instrument able and fitted to apprehend that which is of the spiritual realms. Close quote. Before that supreme act came to pass at Golgotha, the way of those who would enter upon the life of the Spirit lay through the deep mysteries of the temple sanctuaries. The actual awakening of the divine consciousness that speaks through the ego is the very essence of the Christ impulse, and the growth and development of the ancient initiation principle paved the way and made it possible for this great impulse to come to humanity. During the whole future course of evolution, because of the mystery of Golgotha, there will enter into human souls an ever-increasing clarity of understanding and discernment of the divine Spirit to which humanity is so truly united, that same Holy Spirit which even now speaks through the ego when humanity has indeed freed itself from all earthly conditions and circumstances. He who can understand the Gospels from this point of view will realize the wonderful evidence of racial development and preparation for those coming events brought about in the past by the powers of the spirit world. It will be apparent that throughout the ancient Hebrew evolution, humankind was being made ready to hear the voice that would later speak through the deep center of the human being, the ego center, even as the spirit of the old Hebrew race spoke to Judaism. But the people of other nations have heard no such voice, for they were conscious of the divine spirit only as it held converse with the soul in the case of those who were truly initiated. It had become clear to Judaism that the evolution of humankind is a continuous process of development and progress, and that deep within the human ego there dwell those mystic forces that appertain to the human being's innermost being. Hence the Jew became conscious of this thought, quote, when, as an isolated personality, a part of the ancient Hebrew race, I look back upon the course of human evolution from the time of Abraham and realize that supreme deity who has ruled over all things from generation to generation, there comes over me a vague, indefinable feeling that everything divine and of that holy spiritual power that has fashioned the individual qualities of humankind lives in me. Close quote. In this way, the individual members of the old Hebrew race felt that they were united and at one with Abraham, their father. But Christianity definitely states that all such thoughts and conceptions concerning the godlike qualities in the human being are lacking completeness and fail to picture human beings in their most perfect form, even though they believe within themselves that, quote, I am that I am, close quote. A true realization of those divine attributes and forces active deep within humanity can come only when there is a clear apprehension of those things that are of the Spirit and lie beyond all human generations. Therefore, if we would give the preceding words their fuller and truer meaning, we should say, quote, before Abraham was the I am, close quote. This implies that the human ego is eternal, and that in the beginning was the same godlike element that has continued throughout all generations and will be forevermore. To this the Hebrew would add, quote, look not upon that which fades away and is of human material being, but regard only the divine essence that has lived and flowed in the blood of all the descendants of Abraham, who was indeed our father, See to it that you know and discern this Holy Spirit in each one of God's children. But seek it not in the bond that unites brother and sister, but in that which abides in each one of you and comes to light when human beings in solitude know themselves in their innermost soul and cry out, I am. Christ Jesus uttered words of similar intent, and which we must interpret in like manner. With one modification they are as follows, quote, If any man come to me and forsaketh, bracket, hate in Luke 14:26, close bracket, not his father and mother, and wife and children, and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple, close quote. Footnote. What is here implied is that the longing to be at one with the Christ Spirit that came into the world through Jesus of Nazareth should be so intense that each of his disciples must be ready to sacrifice all ties of human love so that he may devote his life and being to the absolute service of the Christ who manifests within. Judging from the context, the word hate found in Luke 14:26 would appear to be of doubtful origin. End of footnote. We must not regard the significance of this passage as in any way conflicting with the just claims of relationship and child love, but rather as indicating that the Christ had brought into the world the principle of divine spirit that all human beings, because they are human beings, may find if they only seek steadfastly in the very center of their being. It was because of this transcendent deed that afterward humankind would enter into closer and closer contact with the very heart of Christianity. Then would this most sacred principle rise up supreme, and, while overcoming all diversity and error, bring about the realization of that universal quality that all may discern who look deeply within. The old gods were ethnic gods, clan gods, and were connected to certain tribal characteristics. Something of the same nature may be ascribed to Hinduism, and even somewhat to Buddhism. But the God who stands revealed through Christianity is one who will raise humankind above all human discord and divergence, and lead them on to that which they truly are, because they are indeed human beings. Those who would gain knowledge of the fundamental character of the Christian doctrine must necessarily regard those spiritual powers and impulses that have guided supreme events in world history as realities. Bracket, they cannot aver that all was begotten of mere chance actions and purely human mental activity, close bracket. They must break away from previous concepts of what is basic and of primary historic import, for happenings that have long been so regarded in reality lie upon the surface of the world's actual growth. Underlying and controlling all human progress and development are beings far above humans' normal powers of sense perception, who are just as real as is the animal and the human being in our material world. Supreme and preeminent among those spirit mentors who govern and direct the growth and development of humanity is the Christ. That Christ who, according to the ancient gnosis, was active in the body of Jesus of Nazareth for a period of 3 years. Once again do we realize that spiritual science has attained to a concept and understanding that enables it to throw light upon matters that have already claimed the attention of external science. Science has been forced to admit that with respect to the Christ we are not merely concerned with a man, but with a divine being, who, while he ruled and gave guidance, must in a certain sense be considered as active within the man Jesus. Here, however, we come upon a situation with which external science is unable to cope. Spiritual science, on the other hand, leads us to the direct contemplation of beings thus acted upon and made subservient to divine spiritual powers in the manner indicated, and regards such states as actually having occurred. Thus it can approach this sphere of modern investigation in a proper and logical manner. An amazing feature of 20th century spiritual development will be that external science will recognize and acknowledge that the concepts of the 19th century were in error, insofar as an attempt was then made to reduce the life of Christ Jesus to a life of Jesus of Nazareth only. Further, it will be found that the final result of all research in this field will prove that in Christ Jesus we are concerned with a God. When any science proclaims this truth, it is a sign that it has begun to follow the true path. Spiritual science would merely add that if humankind once admits the truth of this statement, it may go forward assured that it is upon a certain and absolute foundation. The concept expressed in this assertion is certainly in direct opposition to that material, monistic, cosmic conception formed in modern times. In the two lectures to which I have already referred, quote, The Origin of the Human Being, close quote, and quote, The Origin of the Animal Kingdom, close quote, we have seen that spiritual science was in complete accord with the actual facts brought to light by external science. We would here say that in the matter we are now considering, spiritual science is again disposed to associate itself with the results of conscientious scientific research. Where there is doubt and divergence, it will be found that external science falls short of that goal that may be reached through the methods of spiritual science. Today, human beings regard human life and human understanding, as they appear to them in the physical world, as if they were irreconcilable with a closely associated and actual outer spiritual realm. They further believe that at the most, human beings' greatest fault can lie only in forming wrong conceptions of the material world, or in doing something looked upon as detrimental or malicious, and that does not conform with outer and apparent progress. It is the custom of the present time, in connection with the existing cosmic concept, to seek the origin of phenomena only in that which is close at hand. It has become more and more clear, the further human beings penetrate into spiritual life, that a point has been reached with regard to this method where a complete change in ideas has become necessary. Both natural science and history have to come to a stage where there is definite skepticism concerning all spiritual matters, and these external sciences are now employed merely in collecting and associating outer perceptual facts, wholly regardless of that underlying spiritual reality that may be apprehended in all phenomena capable of sense perception. One might almost say that our present period has reached a point where scientific thought must be reversed and assume a directly opposite attitude. The soul, through its constant inner striving, will in the end lead ultra-materialism and ultra-materialistic monism to adopt a concept that as yet has played but a small part in human ideas concerning the cosmos. In future investigations into the origin of things, there will enter thoughts and ideas so far not generally accepted. In my two works, titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity and titled Truth and Science, I have explained that human beings have been compelled to assume that the position in which they find themselves relative to the world is not their true position, and that they must first undergo a development of inner life so that they may recognize reality in natural phenomena, in order to be able to place themselves in a just and ethical relation to such phenomena. Footnote. This work, originally called by Rudolf Steiner, titled Die Philosophie der Freiheit, The Philosophy of Freedom, Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, is volume 4 in the collected works of Rudolf Steiner. It has also been published as, titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, and also the title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, at the Pacific Press, 1995. End of footnote. Moreover, in the mind of human beings, there must dawn a clear understanding of the fundamental idea of redemption, in addition to mere apprehension of causative factors in life. It will be a task of the 20th century to gain general acceptance of the concepts pertaining to redemption, deliverance, and reincarnation among the external sciences. The position that human beings have assumed as expert and judge of the world does not represent reality, for they can arrive at true concepts only after they have freed themselves from their present false ideas, risen to a higher standard of thought, and overcome those barriers that cause them to view all things in distorted and unreal form. Such a consummation would be perceptive redemption. Moral redemption comes about when human beings feel that the position they occupy in their relation to the world is not their true standing, and when they realize that they must seek a path leading over those obstacles that tower above them, blocking the way to all things pertaining to their true place in life. Concepts of the soul's rebirth upon a higher plane will yet be evolved from the wonders that come to light through the investigations of natural science and the results of historical research. Human beings will then know, if they picture the world as in a photographic image and conjure forth a vision of the scientific and historic progress of humankind, that this vision does not represent the material world alone. For underlying all human advancement, there is clear evidence of a mighty spiritual plan of earnest training and development. They will no longer believe that the world is depicted by science, They will no longer believe that the world as depicted by science is a mere physical creation. For they will realize that God's laws are always operative in such a manner as to bring about his gradual unfoldment. If only natural science would extend its sphere of action beyond a mere portrayal of the perceptual world, and rightly educate humankind so that the human soul might break away from a position that is untenable and rise to a state that would permit its rebirth into a more exalted life. And if human beings could know how glorious would then be the freedom from that restraint that hinders upward progress, they would indeed have developed within themselves those things fundamental to a true world concept of the Christ impulse. They would realize that they have power to look back into the gray mists of the past, to a period to which we have often referred, when their true being dwelt in a purely spiritual realm, later to descend into the material world, that they might there, of their own effort, further their growth and advancement. Then would humankind understand the reason why it became imperative, at a certain definite period in earthly progress, that a complete change of thought, a reversal of ideas, be brought about. They would know that it was in order that all might be empowered to tear themselves away from those false, deceptive, material concepts that have entered so deeply into human consciousness. It is the Christ impulse that has checked human beings' fall and has saved humanity from being utterly immersed in those things that are only of the material world and have neither value nor reality. With respect to the evolution of humanity, the Christ is to be regarded objectively as the divine principle that is the source of our experience of a sacred power and quality entering the soul when reborn and freed of all those primal transgressive tendencies that seek to find expression when the human being is associated with external earthly progress. It is this most holy essence flowing in upon the world that is indeed the manifestation we know as the Christ. If the 20th century would regard the glorious realities of the human being's inner life in a serious light, it would understand the Christ event and no more be in conflict with the concept and truth of those happenings that take place during the soul's rebirth into a higher sphere. Spiritual science would then prove that the same actual principles underlie all historic progress and development as are obtained in the case of external natural phenomena and occurrences. With regard to human beings' ideas concerning the cosmos, they have fallen into the very error that finds expression in the words of Schopenhauer, quote, "The world is my own conception," close quote. This statement implies that we are surrounded by a universe of color, sound, and so forth that is dependent entirely upon the action of the eye, EYE, and other sense organs for its being. But if we seek to comprehend the world in its totality, It is not true to say, quote, all color has existence only by virtue of the physical constitution of the eye, close quote. For the organ of sight would not be there if the light had not first conjured it into being. If, on the one hand, it is true that the sensation of light is determined by the eye structure, it is equally true, on the other hand, that the eye has been created by the light through the sun's action. Both of these truths must therefore be involved in one incomprehensible reality. Thus do we realize the truth underlying Goethe's words when he says, quote, the eye must thank the light for its being, close quote. From animal matter, the light has brought forth a corresponding instrument suitable to receive its impressions. Thus has the eye formed itself in the light, so that it could be sensible to its touch, and so that the illumination which is within could meet and blend with the rays coming from the outer world. Even as the eye has been fashioned through the light's action, and apprehension of the latter comes through the agency of this organ of vision, so was the fulfillment of the human being's inner Christ experience and rebirth of soul brought about by that supreme Christ event, the mystery of Golgotha. Spiritual science tells us that before the advent of the Christ impulse, such inner experience could occur only under the stimulus of an external influence, created through the agency of the mysteries, and not, as is now the case, through a form of self-initiation induced within a human being's very being. The 20th century will see the dawn of those conditions necessary to a true understanding of the Christ impulse. It will be proved how absolute was its reality as a divine center of spiritual radiance, shining forth with a light that awakens an inner realization of that great truth reflected in these words of Goethe. There is a certain similarity between the relation of the colors and the light waves to the eye, EYE, and the profound mystery of the inner Christ experience. As the eye apprehends the bright radiance of the light, so in human beings' deepest being do they become conscious of the divine essence, the Christ. That their souls can rise up and of their own effort transcend all previous limitations is now possible because the resplendent sun, that grand mystery of Golgotha, has shed its glorious rays upon the world's history. If it were not for that supreme objective event and the objective Christ, there could be no such mysterious, subjective inner experience as will enter into the life of humanity during the 20th century, to be regarded earnestly and from a truly scientific standpoint. Quote, who overcomes himself doth conquer that dread power which holds all beings closely bound. Close quote. One can say that only in so far as we connect ourselves to this self-overcoming, to the mystery of Golgotha, the Christ event, can we first discover the form that we have from our earthly beginning, and see this as something from which we must be redeemed, and recognize that all moral activity and cognition can only be approached through this redemption. It will be through an understanding of inner salvation that humanity will at last learn the true meaning of the concept of redemption as related to life's historic evolution. Finally, we would say that during the 20th century there will spread abroad a great illumination that will bring to humanity a clear comprehension of the Christ impulse, and this new knowledge will be in complete accord with the significance of Goethe's fuller message. Quote, who overcomes himself doth conquer that dread power which holds all beings closely bound, and he shall rise. First dawns the glorious truth in that glad hour, that truth by which through Christ mankind shall gain God's prize. Close quote. Footnote, I'll give the German an attempt here. Von der Gewalt, die alle Wesen bindet, befreit der Mensch sich, der sich überwindet, und in diese Überwindung sich selber erst in Wahrheit findet, wie die ganze Menschheit in Christus sich selber in Wahrheit finden kann. End of footnote. That is the end of Lecture 6 and the end of the book, Turning Points in Spiritual History, collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner.